Hello everyone, my name is Jacob Minnig. I'm the host of the Behavioral Health Integration Podcast. Today we have a very special guest, Randy Anderson.
Randy, it's an honor and pleasure having you on my podcast, man.
Thanks.
So usually when I get started, I ask my guests, you know, what really motivated you to get into the field of recovery and mental health and addiction? Like, when did you know in your life this was your path?
Yeah, great question. So I always like to start out like who I am a little, just a, like Absolutely. The elevator speech, we call it. Please. So my name is Randy Anderson, and I'm a person living in long-term recovery. And what that means to me is I haven't had to have any alcohol or drugs or mood altering substance since January 9, 2005. So this last January, I just celebrated 17 years of abstinence-based recovery.
Amen.
And really because,
congratulations.
Thanks. And because of my recovery though, I'm able to have healthy relationships, own a home, run a successful small business, vote, and even pay taxes. So for me, like my recovery, I always say, if I don't put my recovery first, everything else comes last. That's just how I feel. It's my pathway, and you know, I don't, you know, whatever works for other people is great. What motivated me to get in this field? So also, I think it's important to say that I am also a formerly incarcerated person that was sentenced to 87 months in prison as a first-time nonviolent drug user with no criminal history. And so very devastating, right? Like it was actually quite shocking to me when I got, you know, I got arrested for selling drugs, and I, you know, I had a pretty severe substance use disorder that I was using a lot of drugs to maintain. And I had, and in order to do that, you have to sell a lot of drugs to live that kind of lifestyle. And, you know, and I remember like my attorney kept, I paid a lot of money for an attorney, which I kind of regret now because I don't think he really helped me a whole lot. Mm-hmm. But anyways, he kept saying, you're going to go to prison for a long time. And I'm just like, no, they don't do that to people. Like, right. Anyways, mm-hmm. But they do, yeah. they don't do it as bad anymore, but it's still, the war on drugs is still very much alive. And drugs are still kicking our butt. So let's just, you know, anyway, so what got me in this field is when I got out of prison, I remember in prison, like the gloom and doom, like everyone, you know, everyone's telling you from case managers in the prison to COs mm-hmm. to other inmates, just expect less. Like you're a felon now, like, you know, just, you know, be happy with whatever you get in life. Like, yep. And I'm like, that's bullshit. Excuse my French. I'm just like, mm-hmm. No, like I've never lived like that. I don't take no for an answer. Like, right. And coming from a sales background probably helps me a lot with that mm-hmm. because that's kind of what we're taught. Like, you know, no doesn't mean no. It just means they don't have enough information yet to make a better decision. Right. So anyways, so I got out of prison and I did, I went back into a field I was very familiar with. I went back into home improvement and construction. You know, mm-hmm. I knew what I was good at it, and I knew I could make money doing it. Like I always had been made a lot of money in construction and home improvement sales. And I'm not saying it's to brag, but you know, my first full year out of prison, I made a six-figure salary.
Wow.
Selling windows and siding and attic insulation, right? That yep. I was good at what I did. Really though, it came to a point where I
didn't. Did you also say you're a people person? You're a great people yeah. person too.
Yeah, you have to be to do that kind of work, you know, sales, I think in general, you have to be an extrovert and not afraid to talk to people and mm-hmm. be uncomfortable sometimes and all that fun stuff. But I got to a point where the company I was working for at that time, I just, the owner was really unethical and I just couldn't, my own moral compass said, no, you can't do this anymore. So I quit. I went to work for another home improvement company, did really, really well there. But the owner and I got into a disagreement one day over some training stuff that he asked me to do. And he fired me. And I had never really been fired from a job before in my life. Oh. And that was an eye opener, and I didn't know what I was going to do. So I did, you know, sat on unemployment for a little while. I've never collected unemployment in my life, but my wife's like, he fired you for, you know, no, like, anyways, fought that and won. Finally, my wife said to me, hey, you know, you've always talked about wanting to be a counselor. Maybe now's the time to go, you know, take some time and go back to school. Like we have money and savings. She had a good job. Like, why don't you go get the first step out of the way? And the first step we've talked about in the past was me going to get my associate's degree in addiction counseling. And I had no college experience, like none. Like, in mm-hmm. fact, I always say the second scariest day of my life was driving to college. The first was driving to prison. Mm-hmm. College was death. I was scared to death. I mean, I got a GED while I was incarcerated. Okay. And I thought there's no way, like, college is not a thing for me. Right. I'm too old, not smart mm-hmm. enough. Although all those fears that you put up. And I did it. And I took 2 years off and I went to Minneapolis College, Minneapolis Community Technical College at the time. And I took their addiction counseling program and I got my AAS degree and I started getting in the field. But I really thought, like, I always, you know, I think for me, and I think for a lot of people, part of recovery is giving back. Like, right. How do we, you know, I remember my counselor in treatment said, we all have a using debt to pay, like, for mm-hmm. those in recovery. And how do we build recovery capital and collect and build up that bank account? So when that debt comes calling, like, we have recovery capital to, like, help pay off that debt. Right. And for me, and I thought, well, I can do that and I can make a living. So amen. I can give back and do something like that pays my bills. And so that was how I decided to go into the counseling field.
Yeah.
I did that. And then I went on to Bethel University and got my bachelor's degree in human services and became a fully licensed LADC in 2018. Nice. Did that for a couple of years. Oh, no, excuse me, 2016. Did that for, oh God, I'm getting my years confused. I got fully licensed in 2017 or 18, maybe. I can't remember now all the exact dates. Mm-hmm. But anyways, I did that. I worked at Eden House in Minneapolis, a treatment program where I actually went to treatment myself in 2004 oh, nice. And five. In fact, my office was my old counselor's office. So a lot of cool stuff wow. happening there. Yeah. Really, really, really cool. And also, like, you know, sitting in that office at oh, knowing God, at one time yeah. I was in the other chair and now I'm in the office chair. Right.
That's special. That's
yeah. And I think it helped the guys. I think it helped me relate to the guys a lot because, you know, they, you know, sometimes you go to treatment, you're not like, you don't want to be there. Right. Or a lot mm-hmm. of times, like, you know, you're there because you've been forced to go there. You've been yep. told to go there. You have something to lose if you don't go there. Right. And I remember guys coming in and, you know, you can just see the frustration on their faces. And I'd say to them, you know, thank you for being here. I said, do you mind if I just share a quick tidbit with you? And they're like, mm-hmm. sure, go ahead. I'm like, you know, I remember the day I sat in that chair and they're like, what do you mean? I said, that chair you're sitting in, like, I sat there once. And they're like, what? Like, yeah, I said, this used to be my counselor's office. And I said, and I understand what you might be feeling or going through right now, yep. because I was going through. And anyways, you can just see the, like, they take a deep breath, like a sigh, the shoulders drop yep. a little bit. The guard lets down, right? You're like, yep. that's the end. Like, that was my end. Like, that was my, hey, like, you want to yep. build instant rapport? That was the way, like, for me, that was instantaneous. Like, oh my God, here's somebody that understands what I'm feeling right now, right? Yeah. Anyways, I did that as in a high intensity residential program for a couple of years. And if you're an LADC, you know how hard that can be.
Yes.
Like, the stress of caseloads and documentation and groups and all that stuff.
Oh,
and,
yeah.
And on top of that, it's a high intensity residential program where crises are happening multiple times a day. Yep. And I got burnt out, like, really quickly burnt out. And I wasn't happy anymore. And I was at home doing documentation sometimes till 10, 11 o'clock at night. And my wife finally said, "This, you're done. Like, what do you cannot continue on this path. Mm-hmm. You're going to kill yourself." And so I had to take a really look at what I was doing. And another opportunity came up where I quit being a counselor for a while, and I took it yep. for about a year. Then I did that for an organization. I worked as their overdose prevention manager doing Narcan trainings, which is actually really amazing. I've been doing that since 2014. I traveled the entire state of Minnesota. I'm probably one of the few people in our state that can say I've physically been in every county in Minnesota.
Oh, wow.
I've done a Narcan training or a naloxone training in all 87 counties. And so, and that was really fun work traveling around the state. Again, unfortunately, just the way it is, my boss at that organization and I I felt very micromanaged I tell people all the time, I'm probably not an easy employee to manage. Like, I'm pretty pig-headed and I'm strong-willed and I have my own ideas of how things should be done. And yep. like, I always tell my bosses, though, like, just tell me what the goals you're looking for or yep. the outcomes you're expecting, and I'll get there. Like,
let me ride.
I may not, I may not get there the way you think I should get there, but I guarantee you I'll get there. In fact, yeah. Not only will I get there, I'll blow those goals and outcomes out of the water, yep. because that's what I do. Anyways, that she still couldn't like let the reins go. And so I finally said, I can't do anymore. And so I quit. I quit by email at like 9:30 at night. One night I said effective immediately, and what a shitty way to go. But I was just so frustrated and mad. And then I didn't know what I was going to do. But I knew about this peer recovery stuff. Like I had a friend that was doing it and really loved it. And I'm like, I want to learn more about that. So I dove into the peer lane full on, full bore. And I decided that that's what I wanted to focus on, and still didn't know what that looked like. But then I found out, like, I tried to connect with a local RCO here, recovery community organization, to do some training with them, but they weren't looking at hiring any trainers or doing any more work around that. So I was a little let down or disappointed, but then I discovered an organization called CCAR, which is the Connecticut Community for Addiction Recovery. They're out of Connecticut, the East Coast, and they have this training program where you can become an authorized trainer for them. And and their curriculum is accepted in more than 30 states in the country, and meets the certification requirement. So I'm like, well, this is so. After several months, you know, 5-6 months and thousands of dollars, I became a facilitator for the peer recovery curriculum, and I got, you know, approved here in Minnesota, and now I'm an approved provider in Minnesota for the peer recovery curriculum, and I train recovery coaches, or we call them peer recovery specialists. And I never thought, again, I always like speaking and public stuff, and this is a way that I could combine like providing education to people and like doing what I love, talking to people, like, right. Yeah. And so it was a really no brainer for me. And that's how I landed in the peer space, was, and became really passionate and learned as much, and still learning, of course, but I wanted to, and, you know, my wife makes fun of me and I'm in recovery. And so I say this a little facetiously, but she's a normie. So she can have a glass of wine or a beer,
be okay with that.
Right, not me, no, right, but she says, you're like the foam on a good beer, you always rise to the top. And like, that's how I feel about this peer recovery stuff. Like, I want to be, I'm not gonna lie, like, I want myself and Bold North Recovery to be the training provider for peer recovery services, training services in Minnesota. Like, I want to be the go-to guy, and I want to be like the subject matter expert that people look to, like, when it comes to this. And so I think I'm getting there. At least it looks like it. I recently been fortunate enough to, got approved for a fairly large DHS grant to do it, which I can't say it publicly yet, because the contract's not signed. And they told me to be very careful about talking about it until I have a signed contract, but it's really exciting. I never in my life thought I would even be eligible and then get a grant of this size for
my awesome, business,
but it'll really help me. And it'll really help me sustain and build the peer recovery workforce in Minnesota. And that's what I'm most excited about. So, but anyways, long answer to how I got to the peer recovery stuff, but that's how I got there. It's just, that's where I've landed. And here I'm still in LADC, and I tell people all the time, I spent 5 years of my life and more than $50,000 obtaining that license and that degree, degrees. Yeah, yeah. I'm not going to let it go either.
Yeah, so good.
I'm going to maintain it and like get the, you know, and keep that. And it's also a good credential. It adds some legitimacy and people, you know, not that I think it's the most important thing anymore. Cause it's cool to have initials after my name. Right. But I also now, when I talk to people and they talk about credentialing, you know, I've kind of changed how I think about credentialing or what a credential looks like. I often now times say, I mean, my number one credential is my 17 years of recovery.
Yeah.
My second most valuable credential is my 5 years of prison. And then I have a licensed alcohol and drug counselor, a recovery coach professional, like other designations. But really for me, like that lived experience is forefront and the most important part of it.
And can I say something? You can't pay for that experience. Like certifications of the world, everything you've been through, you can't pay for that.
There's no way, there's no amount of money that can, you can't put a price tag on that.
Amen.
Yeah. Yeah. So there you go. So again, long answer.
I love it. No, I love it. Yeah. I love it. You know, cause it's really giving me more ideas too. And I want to discuss. And like you said, the burnout rate for LADCs is pretty high right now. And you went through it. I've seen people go through it. Just what is your perception on that? Is it a little bit of everything, like you kind of mentioned before, the paperwork, the very high caseloads? Like, do you mind if I ask you, what was your average caseload size?
Yeah. So I, and here, and I worked at a, so I worked at a high intensity residential program.
Yeah.
And most times, and I'm not blaming the program. Like I love Eden House and it honestly saved my life. So I'm not here to bash. And we were always understaffed. Like we were always short staffed, there were times I carried most of the time, but at the smallest case that I can ever remember was 12 and the highest was 20 once. Again, that's and people don't like, if you're in the field, you probably get it. I don't think some people in the field even get it, but that's also in a high intensity residential program. That's not like an outpatient program. That's not like a, you know, an aftercare program. That's like, yeah, it was horrible. I mean,
but oh God, like right now I'm struggling with like 12 or 13. Granted, I'm doing other things too, but like you said, most people, especially on this field, don't understand what we go through when it comes just to the paperwork, like one-on-one sessions, weekly treatment plan reviews, comp assessment summaries, treatment plans, discharge summaries,
discharges,
coordination of care,
group running groups. Like you got to do, you know, 20 hours groups. A group a week or whatever it is. I mean, yeah.
Oh, I'm getting like overwhelmed just thinking about it.
I'm sorry. Yeah. Don't. No, yeah. I remember those days and, you know, and then when you're short staffed, not only do you have high caseloads, at one point I was doing 24 to 28, maybe even sometimes 30 hours a group a week because I was filling in where we were short staffed. And so how do you do that? Like, how do you,
it's not fair.
You can't. And the sad thing for me was when I look back at that, and I've said this to DHS, I've said this to program directors, you know, who suffers in the end. I mean, I'm suffering, but who really suffers is the people that need the most help.
Yep.
And those are our clients. Those are clients. They're getting, we're sacrificing. So we start to cut corners, right? Because for us, the first thing that always went out the door when we got short staffed or out of hours was the one-on-ones. Like those became very, if they even happened, they became very short lived. And then that was the first thing we cut out. And that to me was like probably one of the most important things because my cat is scratching at the door. Give me one second. But yeah, so, you know, and that's the sad, I said this to, you know, many people in leadership roles along the journey, that the sad part is if you guys, and I said this to DHS, if you want better outcomes, like you want better results and feel like you're getting a better bang for your buck, like, let me be in front of my patients more, like, let me spend more time with them. Right now, I don't get to spend time with them because of everything else that's happening. So I think it's a huge problem in our field. And I don't know. I've been screaming workforce shortage for many years. I think when I started going to March public policy meetings back in 2014, and I had learned about the background studies thing issue. And then I had found out like people don't get to work in our field because of a criminal background. And I'm like, certain people, right? And I'm like, well, wait a second. Like they're the most, I mean, not the most qualified, but they're highly qualified because of their experience with the justice system and their and treatment and addiction. I mean, they're qualified even more, you know. Anyways, I've been disqualified 7 times by DHS and I've done 4 set asides. And I thankfully, though, that has driven me to help change the system. And I'm working on, I'm not on the task force, but there's a task force that's currently happening for a DHS background study task force. And we're looking at changing 245C15 significantly. Okay. I actually got to recommend 2 people for the task force, and the governor and the Senate liked my recommendation. So I have 2 friends that are sitting on that task force. Nice. So I do have some, I feel really blessed to have some say in who's on there. And then a good friend of mine is the co-chair of the task force. So I'm hopeful that we'll get some really good changes out of that. Cause we need people entering this field, and that process is excluding a lot of people from entering this field.
Yep. Yep. Also, here's my thought too. My past podcast, I always advocate for higher pay for LADCs. And a lot of people just in this field in general deserve more money.
Yeah.
You know, and again, like smaller caseloads, so we can provide better care. And I always try to think like, hey, where are the steps to getting that or eventually getting that someday?
You know? Yeah. I mean, so it's gotten better. I mean, I entered the field in 2015 when I first started as an ADCT.
Yep.
And I started at 38,000, which was horrible, right?
Yep.
Yeah. So, and they wanted to start me at 34, And I said, and it was Eden House, and I had a relationship with them. I've been known them for a decade or longer. And I asked for 42, and they settled on 38. So there was a little negotiation there. They said, they blamed it on their own HR that was the highest level they could put me at according to their pay structure, which, and I know now, I mean, I have friends now that are LADCs that work for, and I'm not going to name drop too many, but Nystrom's or Drew Horowitz, those.
Good guy.
Yeah. And they're for-profit programs, which is, okay. But I know people that are making, close to six figures. As an LADC, because, they're working for a better organization. I'm not saying that's the norm, but I am hearing salaries have gotten better. I'm not in it, so I don't know the current ones. And I think some of the things, like what I see from a 30,000 foot level doing especially legislative work, is that when we get these rate increases for SUD, a lot of times those get absorbed by program costs. They don't trickle down to the actual people doing the work. I think what we need, and I think we're doing that, we're trying to do that more, is when we get these, and they're usually very minuscule rate increases, like 2% or 2.5%. We're actually getting a big one. Hopefully pushing for a 10% this next session. And we want to make sure that trickles down to the actual workers, like that if we're giving 10% more for reimbursement rates, we want salaries also to increase some degree. And so I'm not involved with that work group as much, but I know I'm on the government affairs calls, and I see that's being talked about. But yeah, I don't know. I mean, especially the demands for what we do. I don't know the answer there. I'm not a fan. For a while, we've toyed around with the idea of tiered licensing.
What's that, if you don't mind me asking?
So tiered licensing is that, depending on what level of college you have, is you would base your pay off of.
Okay.
So if you're an ADCT, you get paid so much. If you're an LADC, you get paid so much. And if you're a master's level addiction counselor, you get paid so much. Like they talked about like that tiered licensing. However, though, here's the pushback, and I agree with, like, an ADCT and a master's level, no matter where you fall in there, are doing the same work.
Like, that's true.
So what I don't, there shouldn't be a pay just because you have a more of a degree. Great. Thank you. But you're not doing the work you're doing in the program is the same exact work. And so the pay should be exactly the same. I totally agree with that. What I think we need to do is allow more people. Another way to work on the workforce shortage is allow more people to enter the field, because that having a 4-year degree requirement is very, like, it's not possible for a lot of people.
Yeah.
And a lot of people that enter this field enter later in life because I'm not in school, like high school, I'm going to go be a counselor. Like no one, that's not a thing. It should be, like, we should be recruiting in schools. Like I think. Like going to job fairs at high schools and like talking about the rewarding benefits of being a counselor and blah, blah, blah.
At least let them know about it at least, because it took me forever to even find out like what an addiction counselor was.
Yeah.
Until later in my life. So you're right.
Yeah. Yeah. But, the idea of tiered licensing, and one of the proposals the Board of Behavioral Health and Therapy came up with a few years ago, is allowing someone to enter the field at an associate's level and stay there. Like not having to have to go on to get their bachelor's. They can work on an associate's degree. The only caveat was they still had to be supervised by an LADC. Mm. And I thought that's cool. Like that works. Like we think the work study they did showed that we could probably get more people to enter the field if we added another licensing level versus like the other stuff. But unfortunately, some of the powers to be, and money is always, talked about, that it's hard to justify paying higher wages for someone with only associate's level degree, even though, again, they're doing the same work as the master's level. And that's the part that's frustrating, because it's hard to get, like, when you talk to, and it's our elected officials, like they have this, they've already, they're, unfortunately, they're old white people half the time.
Yep,
and they have this idea in their head that people that have better, more degrees have better, that means they should make more money and have more experience and all that. And it doesn't translate always that way. Like I don't, I know people with PhDs that I wouldn't have them provide therapy to some of my family members.
Research actually says the higher level education you have, like PsyD, PhD, not saying they're all bad therapists, actually provide less care, like less helpful care.
Right.
Than someone with a bachelor's. It's, yeah.
Yeah. So anyways, that's my thought on tiered licensing. Yeah. I think it's a good conversation to have. I think the direction it tried to go at first wasn't the best, for the field. It was more about money than about actually providing real care for people. So unfortunately, yeah. But.
So someone from my side too. So I got my master's a couple of years ago in co-occurring. So I got my LDC and I'm pursuing my LPCC. But it's really cool you said that, because my first internship supervisor, I was talking to her about it, about the pay thing. She's like, yeah, you have a master's degree and everything, and you have some mental health knowledge, but you can't do anything more than LADC, so why should we pay you more? And then I guess I could empathize, obviously. I understand both sides, but someone like me with a master's degree, they're trying to get their LPCC.
Yeah.
Yes, like masters, they make more money, I guess, when it comes to insurance and billing, but they also have the motivation of paying off their student loans, which student loans are ridiculous.
Life, my friend used to call it life crippling debt.
Yep. So, and I can split that too, because as students, we know what we're getting into when we're going to grad school. You know, we should have done the research on what we pay and how we're going to pay it off. So.
Well, I don't even think, I mean, I guess you could do your own research, but there should be some a class or a training on like, okay, here's if you like for every kind of degree, like, I don't think it'd be that hard to say, here's your ROI on it. Like if you invest this kind of money, here's what you expect for a return investment or how long you expect before you have it paid off. Right. They don't do, I mean, there's not enough career planning or career counseling to really help people with that. Not going to lie, like a lot of people that get into our field, I think, you know, are personally impacted in some way. Mm-hmm. And they're so passionate about it, they don't care. Like, right. I want to do this work, whatever it takes. Like, I can't fault them for that either. Right.
Yep.
The nice thing, I mean, eventually when you do your LPCC, you can like, you could move on to some pretty good mental health care that will pay a lot better than the LADC makes too, right? Mm-hmm. So it's not an unworthy goal for sure. So there, kudos to you. My wife, when I talk about graduate school, my wife like talks about divorce. So so she knows how the five years was a tough enough on us just for me to get to my bachelor's degree. And she's like, if you want to do that, maybe, you know, you go get your own apartment for a while.
I'll just tell you right now, I barely made it, man. And looking back, I probably should have taken a break just because just being grad school, it's just like a good thing it wasn't on exams and stuff, because I'm horrible at exams. It's just lots of papers, lots of PowerPoints, a lot of projects. So to all you listeners out there, you know, that was my experience in grad school. So,
yeah.
So another thing I want to get through is I know you do a lot of work through the Committee on Human Services and Reform Finance Policy. Would you care to explain a little bit about that? Because I thought that was pretty cool.
Yeah. So, you know, so I that's just one committee that actually that I work with at the state level Senate committee, because I happen to know the chair really well. Senator Abler is a champion for recovery and treatment services. Like, he's also in recovery himself, although he doesn't openly talk about it. He actually is in recovery. And so that's probably a great reason why he's such a champion for us. He's just not one of those guys that openly talks about it, but yeah, he's definitely, I think he's 25 or 30 years in recovery from alcohol. Right.
Good for him.
He's just not openly discussing it. That's all. You know, maybe a little old school still, where the anonymity piece comes in for him. I don't know, whatever. But I've talked about it, and he's not like, he's not public about it. He's not as out front as like I am about mine. But I love, so one of the things I realized early on in this career is that, especially really going to the March public policy meetings. And for those that don't know what March is, it's a Minnesota Association of Resources and Recovery for Chemical Health. And I think I got the name right. It's a super long name with an acronym that's M-A-R-R-C-H. Yep. They're our largest treatment association in Minnesota. Although they try to encompass recovery, I think we should have our own recovery organization, but working on stuff like that too. Mm-hmm. But anyways, I learned early on attending those public policy meetings and getting involved with March that a great deal of what impacts us either as professionals or citizens or whatever is like policy work. Like if mm-hmm. you're not engaged in policy work, like, so people are going to make decisions for us, whether we want them to or not. Yeah. Like, and so we have a choice here. We can sit back and let those things happen. Right. And say, you know what, we just a lot of times assume that the right things are being decided, mm-hmm. which I learned that that's not always the case. Right. So I have a belief that, so first of all, I'm not okay with anyone making decisions for me. Like, yeah, and even if I, so, you know, they're saying, my dad used to say as a kid, you know, hey kid, either you're on, either you have a seat at the table or you're probably on the menu. And mm-hmm. those kind of sayings, like in my head, like, I'm not on anyone's menu, by the way. So I'm not a token or something you can, you know. So anyways, I decided long ago to get more involved with advocacy, and never did I think how much I would love it. I mean, like, absolutely, like, love hanging out at the Capitol. Yeah. I'm one of those policy nerds that, like, even during mm-hmm. COVID, everything was online. And if I had a couple hours to kill in the middle of the day, I would go on the Minnesota State Legislature website and I would see what hearings are happening. And I mm-hmm. would sit in on some like environmental hearings once in a while, even though I can care less about, not care less, but even though it's not a passion of mine. Right. But I would learn a lot, but I'm one of those people like, and now we're starting to go back in person, which is great. But one of the things we're working on this year, or a couple items that I'm working on this year that I think are really important, is for a long time, this is a very heated, becoming a more heated topic, but I think many people will agree. So DHS, the Department of Human Services in Minnesota, is our state's single largest agency. Like, right, it's a $17 billion a year. That's their annual budget, right? Yep. Our single biggest budget item. I don't remember the number of people they're responsible for serving anymore, but it's unbelievable. But anyways, a lot of people, and me included, believe that DHS is too big and unmanageable. Yep. Like, there's no, I mean, I even said in my testimony at the hearing a couple weeks ago, or, you know, last week, a couple weeks ago, is that, like, no one, who's in charge over there? Like, I mean, like, mm-hmm. for people, most people don't, like, what does that mean? Like, right. I'm lucky enough. Like, I always say I'm pretty privileged, lucky. Like, I know a lot of people at DHS. I'm friends with them. And if I need something, I know who to call. Like, right. Yeah. But I'm very in touch with that, like in tune with that. But for people that isn't their life, like, they want questions answered, or they're working on a program or trying to open up a new facility, and it's just the levels of bureaucracy we're so buried. So substance use disorder and mental health is a division of DHS, mm-hmm. A big division, don't get me wrong, but sometimes it feels like we're just buried in another, you know, just buried along with disability and childcare mm-hmm. and like, you name, like all these stuff that DHS takes care of. But so many years ago, you know, three or four years ago, a lot of us advocates were saying, when people say, how do we fix DHS, right? What's the solution? And we were saying 3 years ago or 4 years ago, there is no fixing DHS. Mm-hmm. Like, the only way to fix it is to break it into smaller, more manageable pieces. Okay. And it's funny that we said that, and now there's efforts being made to do that. So that what I testified in front of Senator Abler's committee in the Senate the other day was about that subject. Mm-hmm. They've introduced legislation to create what's called the Department of Behavioral Health. So that would be its own department, just like DHS is now. Yep. It would be its own department with a cabinet, a commissioner appointed by the governor, its own leadership, its own structure, its own, with a single focus, or maybe a dual focus, on mental health and substance use.
Yes.
And we just feel that we would have our own staff, our own budget, our own voice of the governor's office, which is important to have, right? And so that's what they're trying to do. And I testified, I work with a lot of providers in Minnesota for a lot, various reasons. And I, over and over again, the things I hear the most from them is like, they don't feel like anyone's there to talk to. Like, they don't have any, like, they, when they need questions answered, and I said it in my testimony, and it was ironic, just the day before that, I was talking to a friend of mine who runs a small program, mm-hmm. and she asked some questions to DHS back in October, and she's never received any response from them. And that's unacceptable. Insane. Like you're running a program trying to make a living, you know, help people get their lives on track. Like there's a lot of things tied to what you're doing, and you can't even get answers from the authority that's in charge of like your license, that's in charge of your funding, that's in charge of everything, right? Mm-hmm. And so many of us believe if we had our own department, like the behavioral health department, department, we would have more access and better communication into that. So true or not, I don't know, but what I do know is we're seeing record overdose deaths, we're seeing record suicides across the country. We're seeing skyrocketing mental health issues and concerns. And if we don't, and maybe this isn't the solution, I don't know, but if we don't try something new or different, we cannot continue to do the same thing we're doing because it's not working. So
isn't that the definition of insanity? Like
over and over? Doing the same thing over and over again and expecting different results, right? Oh. That is absolutely definition of insanity. So that's one thing. And I'm only a small player in that legislation. They like me because I know a lot of people, and a lot of people listen to Randy. At least I guess I'm a loud enough voice that some people pay attention to Randy sometimes. Mm-hmm. And so that's kind of why Abler and those guys asked me to testify, because it's funny when I applied for there's a nonprofit in Minnesota that I really wanted to sit on their board. I just thought I could do a lot of good and help them. And I just, you know, I interviewed everything. And one day I'm at a conference with the board president, and he pulls me aside and he goes, "Randy, I just have to, you know, you interviewed well and everyone on the board loves you." And they also work very closely with DHS. Yep. And they're like, "Do you know there are some people at DHS that don't think very highly of you?" I'm like, shocking. I said, "Would you like me to give you their names?" And he goes, "Oh, so you're aware of it." I said, "You know what, if you do the work I do and you're an advocate and you're pushing against these systems, you're going to make, not everyone's going to like you." And I'm okay with that. Mm-hmm. And I said to that board president, I said, "If me sitting on your board hurts your relationship with DHS, I don't want to be on your board. Like, that's not, I don't want to, like, you got, if you feel that relationship is that important and you don't want to do damage to it by me," I said, you're not going to hurt my feelings. Like, I'm okay with that. Like, right. Mm-hmm. But it's just sometimes when you do this work and you just, not everyone agrees. And that's, so again, I'm just a small part of that one. The one I'm most excited about is I'm working on a new piece. So there, I introduced, it's no longer now. Senator Abler is now the author of it, but I was the idea. The idea behind it was he asked back in mid to late last year, I was asked by some people, what do you think the recovery field is missing? And we talked about a lot of stuff, but one thing I thought of was like, and it was just like, and I don't know why a lot of people are getting mad at me again already, but like I was thinking of peer recovery services, and like we're doing peer recovery services in treatment courts. We're doing peer recovery services in collegiate recovery programs, recovery high schools, jail and prison programs, all over the place, treatment programs, recovery community organizations, emergency room departments. Like we have, but do you know that the only two places that you can get reimbursed for peer recovery services are 245G programs and credentialed RCOs. That means all those other places are providing the service either because they want to and they know it's important, but most of the time it's only because of a grant.
Yeah.
And so once the grant runs out, guess what happens to the service? It goes away.
Yeah.
It doesn't continue because they're not going to take money out of their own budget to continue paying for something. And that's just the reality. I'm not even like trying to, like, that's the reality. Yeah. Like from a business perspective, most of them treat, you know, it's a business. How do I pay for this? Right. And so my idea was, what if we credentialed and I license, credential, certify, whatever term you like to use, all these programs to provide peer recovery services and seek reimbursement for it. And so, the guy, the senator I was talking to, loved the idea. He goes, "Oh my God, that's amazing. Yep. Like, what would we call it? How would that look?" I said, "I don't know. Like, let's elevate the recovery voices and like, let's make a," so I came up with the idea of the Minnesota Board of Recovery Services, like a state level board, just like the Board of Behavioral Health and Therapy, just like the Board of Nursing, just like a state level board made up of the recovery community. And then the recovery community would decide who gets credentialed and who can provide this service and seek reimbursement. And I thought like this, and I talked to a lot of people, not everyone, of course, because you can't talk to everyone, but I talked to a lot of people. This conversation for me started a couple years ago, and they thought, wow, that's an amazing idea. We'll never, of course, at that time, they're like, you'll never make this happen and blah, blah. Yep. And at that time they were right. Like, no, I couldn't get anyone to buy into that, but I did now. That's and awesome. So there's actually proposed legislation. I don't have the bill number yet, but there is a bill. We're just waiting for the bill number. And Senator Abeler is the chief author in the House. Okay. Senator Eaton is going to, I talked to her on Thursday. I was up at the Capitol. She's going to sign on as a co-author. So I'm getting some, so, and then we're working on the House side. We don't know what's there yet, but I think some people are really scared. And I understand, like, some of the RCOs are, what I'm trying to do, are scared of this. And the main reason is funding. Like, typically, funding for recovery services has been little to nothing.
Yeah.
And so the little bit of money they get, they're afraid is going to now be spread thinner, and they're not going to get, I get it. Like, I'm not even for a second pretending that I don't understand what they're thinking about. There's one little part that many of them don't understand, and which I'm working on too. Cool. At a federal level, we're asking, the Biden budget is actually doing what's called a 10% recovery set aside through the block grants. So that would be another, we already get a substance use block grant, we get a mental health block grant, and now we want what's called a recovery block grant. Okay. And it would be about, so we're asking for 10% of whatever the substance use block grant is to be that amount for us for the recovery block grant. And then that funding would go to each state, would get whatever their portion is, and it would have to be used directly for peer recovery services.
Okay.
And so that for Minnesota right now, so unfortunately the feds didn't pass a budget either, because they're like a lot like other places, but they're very torn about how money should be spent. But we're still operating at a federal level under the Trump budget. And many people don't even know that. Like, we're still operating under the previous administration's budget because our feds couldn't pass a budget. However, they're going to be forced to. They have no choice but at the end of this year to actually pass a real budget. But our 10% recovery set aside is actually in all three budgets right now. It's sitting in the Biden budget, it's in the House budget, and it's in the Senate budget. So the odds of getting to the finish line are very good.
Yep.
Like,
good.
The amount of money, we sound like we might, they call it getting a haircut. It sounds like they may trim some of our funding. But as it currently sits, Minnesota would stand to get $4 million from the feds every year.
Wow.
For peer recovery services. And so, that's awesome. And that's the other part. So of course, knowing this, like, to me, having this board of the Minnesota Board of Recovery Services, we would have this money coming into state, and then we would get to decide what to do with it. Like, instead of letting DHS decide what to do with it, or letting,
I like that idea.
Yeah. I mean, anytime we can take the power away from the government and have the people making those decisions, it's just a better system.
It is.
Anyway, so that's the part, the RCOs. And I don't mean to be like, I work with all the RCOs, and my grant is actually written to work with all the RCOs. So I'm going to partner with them, whether they like me or not. But like, sometimes I say the term that comes to mind for me is they can't see the forest through the trees.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's hard sometimes. And it's usually it usually comes from a fear or scarcity based thought process.
Yeah.
And so anyways, we have education to do with them even. And I like, oh my God, I have a million meetings set up where I have to meet with different people, and that's okay. Yeah. Like, that's, something's going to happen this year. And so I told the RCOs, like, honestly, you can join us and be part of the conversation, or you can continue to sit back and bitch about it. Come on in, like, help us make this the best it can be.
Yeah.
Because we want to do that. That one there is my baby this year, because it's kind of my bill. So I'm babysitting that one. But I also know that a lot of people are mad at me right now because of it. That's okay. So
it's part of life,
again,
man.
Yeah. I've done a lot of talking. I'm really sorry.
No, Jacob, I love it, man.
So
no, man, you got my full support in that for sure. And now I was just wondering if you talk about more of another passion project of yours, or it's more, I guess, your organization, the Bold North Recovery Consulting.
Yeah. So it's always, I like to tell a little story of how Bold North was born.
Please.
When I quit my last job in 2018, I had one more duty to perform for that organization. I had to go deliver 4 Narcan kits to the White Bear Lake High School. I had just finished a 2-year project implementing a Narcan program in our state the first Narcan, you know, high school in our state. Like Wiper Lake was the first one.
Okay.
And part of the deal was that it would get, we were going to donate 4 Narcan kits to the high school for them to have. Well, I had those kits still and I'd quit the night before for my job. And I'm like, no, I'm going to finish. This is the last, I have to finish this. Then I'll be done. Right. And that morning it happened to be us February 25th, February 26th in Minnesota. Mm-hmm. There was a snowstorm that day. And if, interesting enough, I woke up early like I do. And I changed my Facebook status to left that organization.
Mm-hmm.
And I got in my car and I started driving. And all of a sudden my phone blew up. Like people texting and calling and emailing, like, oh my God, what happened? Yeah. Like, why did you leave? I mean, I just thought just from a social media post, right?
Uh-huh.
And well, one of my friends that called worked for a SAMHSA funded organization called the Great Lakes Addiction Technology Transfer Center.
Oh wow.
And she's like, Randy, I just like, you know, I have work for you. So the problem is they have contract work all the time. She goes, but I can't contract with a person. I have to contract with a business. Okay. And so she goes, if you had an LLC, I have work for you right away. And I'm like, well, Julia, her name's Julia. I said, Julia, I'm not like, I'm taking 2 weeks off. I'm going to write a business plan.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to figure out where I want to go next. I'm not doing this. Like, she's like, okay, well, I just thought I'd let you know. Well, that was like when I started my drive to Wiper Lake. And it, by the way, it took me 5 hours to drive from Golden Valley to Wiper Lake and back that day because of the snowstorm. Mm-hmm. So I was stuck in my car in my own thoughts. So I started that idea started running through my head. Like, what if I did have my own business and what would that look like? And then I started toying with names and I'm like, and I don't know right away. So had to have recovery in it somewhere because I wanted people to know that I'm a recovery focused organization. Yep. Right. So, and then I started thinking about like my personality and the state we live in. And all of a sudden the word Bold North came up. And that funny, ironically enough, I may have stole it a little bit. So when the Super Bowl was here, they did, that was their tagline for the Super Bowl too, was Bold mm-hmm. North. But anyways, and there was no trademark or patent on it, but anyways, mm-hmm. I also loved it because I think it describes Minnesota, but it also describes me, at the same time, because I consider myself to be a pretty bold individual. And so I got home from the snowstorm. I went on the Secretary of State website and I searched to file for a business, right? Bold North Recovery. And there was already an existing company called that. I'm like, what the heck? And I looked and they were a towing firm. So they towed cars and I got it. So I used to drive tow trucks. So I understand we used to say, mm-hmm. so recovery was the word we use. We're recovering vehicles. So I got it. Like the thing was, I don't think they were even in business anymore, but because they were still listed on the website, I couldn't have the name. And I'm like, shit, what am I going to do? So I started, mm-hmm. My wife was there and we're thinking and like, so then I said, well, what do you want to do? I said, well, I want to consult. I want to work with all organizations. So anyways, mm-hmm. then I added on the word and consulting. So that's how it was born. Bold North Recovery and Consulting. And I went,
nice.
It just went on the website. I paid the $155 and I was, you know, I did all the, wrote some quick articles of incorporation and all that shit. And I became a legitimate LLC that day. And I had work the next week with the place my friend had said, like, I have work for you. And I immediately started contracting. I had no idea what I was going to do at that time. Mm-hmm. I mean, I came up with ideas. I knew I wanted to do peer recovery stuff. I wanted to continue my overdose prevention work. Yeah. I loved advocacy and I was a counselor. So I said, oh, there's my four pillars right there.
Yep.
Like I can, you know, I just love the idea of like having, I love those concepts of like three-legged stools or four pillars or things like that. What holds you up? Right. And so anyways, my four pillars, they've changed over the years. They're the same four, but the order's changed because it started off with like counseling first, because I was an LADC.
Yep.
So it was counseling, like overdose prevention, advocacy and peer recovery services and now it's changed. Now it's flipped. Now a peer recovery services is number one and overdose prevention is number two and advocacy is three and counseling is like, counseling may even drop off at some point, which is kind of, mm-hmm. although I do envision one day, maybe Bold North Recovery expanding. Like I could see me opening some sober homes, maybe.
That's cool.
And maybe outpatient treatment program. So maintaining that LADC portion to me is also valuable because it'll help when I do that kind of, if I decide to do that stuff, but yeah, go ahead.
So when you're an LADC, do you act as an independent contractor as an LADC or how would that work for you?
You can. So you have to have an LADC for a minimum of 3 years.
Oh, okay.
You can, So I'm now eligible. I think I've had my LADC for 3 years now. So I don't need to, I'm not required to be supervised by anyone anymore as an independent. So if I were to open up, like in 2018, Minnesota passed the law that LADCs could hang a shingle. So you can, you can go into private practice and set up insurance contracts if you want to, or however you want to do it. So we are now, LADCs are now a lot like mental health providers, that we can just hang a shingle and say, we provide private services. The only caveat to being an LADC is they did say, if you haven't been an LADC for at least 3 years, you had to be, have a supervisor, like an approved, like whatever that is. So I've avoided that because I'm like, you know what? I don't need my friend. And I have a really good friend, Julie, who runs a training program, and she's got all the credentials. She goes, Rand, if you ever want to do that, like, you can just put my name down. I don't care. I just never got there because I got so involved with the peer recovery stuff. But yeah, I envision one day, you know, maybe having, you know, who knows, maybe an office that offers multiple, you know, services that, the nice thing is being an LADC, I can supervise peers too. That's in Minnesota, you have to have a behavioral health license to be a peer supervisor. Although I think we need to do some changes in that. I found out though, it's CMS rules that's because of that. So CMS has it written that a peer recovery specialist needs to be supervised by somebody with a behavioral health license.
Yep.
So that sounds great and all in theory until you start. I see the problem. The problem I see with it, most people with behavioral health license have no idea what peer recovery specialists do.
Yeah.
They don't. They're clinical and we're not, and they're non-clinical. I mean, it's just one of the solutions I had a couple of years ago, I talked to about introducing legislation to make it a requirement that if you want to supervise peers, you had to take a recovery coach academy. The treatment world lost their goddamn mind when I said that, because they're like, we're not going to make someone go through a 46-hour class, and who's going to pay for it, and blah, blah. I'm like, Jesus, people, it was just an idea. Like, chill out.
I like that idea. So just a disclosure, I am not in recovery, but I did have strong interest in doing the peer recovery thing.
Yeah,
I was told, and I don't know if this is correct information, that I was not allowed to because I am not in recovery, so I'm not eligible to be a peer recovery specialist. Is that true, or...?
So in Minnesota, currently, you have to become certified peer recovery specialist, you have to identify as a person in recovery from substance use.
Okay.
However, so there's a, we talk about this. When I do trainings, I talk about, is that legal? Mm. So is it legal? So doesn't the American Disabilities Act protect you from disclosing a medical condition for employment purposes? Yeah. So technically it does. No one has ever challenged that in a court yet, though. So a part of it is the only way that's going to ever change is we believe that someone will have to actually sue someone, and we'll have to get either a federal court or the Supreme Court to rule that you can't do that. There is a case now, though, which is the start of this domino, I think. So just February 24th, the Department of Justice filed a lawsuit against the Pennsylvania court system for denying people their opioid use medication. Because that's against the ADA. Mm-hmm. Like, you can't say as a court, you can't say, oh, you have to go off your methadone, or you have to taper off, or you can't take it, or that's against the law, like, period. Yep. No one's ever challenged it except for now. So the Department of Justice filed a lawsuit on February 24th against the entire state of Pennsylvania and their drug court system for denying people medications for their opioid use disorder. Why that's significant is because this could be the domino effect to start talking about other areas of substance use and recovery. Like, can we even make someone disclose their medical record for employment purposes? Legally, you can't. And so anyways, we're probably a long ways from that. So in Minnesota, you still have to, the rules are, you have to identify as a person in recovery from substance. We are looking, though, there's other ones. So we're looking at some other tracks. So one of the tracks we're looking at is a family peer recovery specialist.
Okay.
So a person that's a family member that it's had, you know, a loved one in recovery, you know, struggling, like, have a separate credential for that.
Okay.
So we're exploring those avenues. I don't know, though, they're probably still a ways off yet, you know, a few years, but other states do it already where they have family recovery specialists where it's a family member. You take the initial RCA, and then you take like a 24-hour add-on class, and then you become what's called a certified family peer recovery specialist.
Yep.
So anyways, we're working on those things. Those are, Not very fast moving items, but there are things we're talking about. So
good. Well, then now also another huge thing is the do's and don'ts of peer recovery. And again, I just absolutely love your poster.
Yeah.
On LinkedIn explaining all that, man. I wish I had one. I really did.
Well, I could send you the PDF PowerPoint of how that presentation was born.
Oh,
it's interesting. I had never done a poster board. So part of my strategy this year with Bold North Recovery is to go to a lot more community events. So I want to have table, like a resource table at community events, be an exhibitor. I'm submitting to literally like submitting proposals to present at multiple conferences, like the NATAB, which is the National Association of Treatment Providers, NADAC, the RX Summit, Multiple Pathways Recovery. Like I've submitted, this week I got denied by NATAB, which not surprising. But then I also got accepted. So Metro State is doing a recovery conference this year, and I've submitted there, and they're letting me do two presentations there. So that's really cool.
Awesome.
But this particular, so I submitted to the RX Summit, which is in Atlanta every year. It's a huge conference.
Mm-hmm.
And I submitted to present this Who's Who in the Zoo. They denied me, but they said they were very intrigued by my proposal. And they offered me what's called a poster board presentation. And what that means is they're going to give me a 4 foot high by 8 foot wide piece of plywood, basically, to stick this poster on. I had to convert my presentation into a poster board.
Yep.
And I'd never done one. I went online and I Googled how to do it. Mm-hmm. You do it in, like I did it in PowerPoint. It actually wasn't hard to create it. It was hard to create it and keep it on, like, get, because that, how do you turn an hour and a half presentation into a poster, right?
Right.
Like that was the challenge for me. And this is my first attempt, and I now see ways that I can improve, and that's fine. I found a place that printed that thing though for 50, mm-hmm. 75 bucks.
Okay.
So it's on a piece of vinyl and it's 4 foot high, and I'm going to ship it to Atlanta for the conference. And they give me the board and the pins to push it, to put it on. So there'll be a lot of these displayed in the exhibit hall.
Yep.
There'll be an area of the exhibit hall called poster board area where New Way is going to be there. I found out. So my friend New Way saw it and she's like, oh, we'll be there with our own poster board. And so, but yeah, so that's my first one I've ever done. And I was pretty satisfied with my first attempt. Again, I know how I could do it better next time. The nice thing is I didn't have a lot of money invested in that. Thank God. I got quotes to print that thing locally here. And one place was like $237. I'm like, no, like I'm probably going to use it once and throw it away. I'm not spending that kind of money.
Yep.
But then I found a place online at 75 bucks, printed in color on vinyl. It turned out, I'm like, wow, this turned out better than I anticipated. And I can, for 75 bucks, I can throw it away when I'm done. I don't give a shit. So anyways, but yeah.
Yep. Oh man. So sticking to peer recovery specialists, I want to tell you my experience where, and I don't understand this, but you know, when I talk to other healthcare professionals, I guess there's a thing going on with LADCs, not all LADCs, but a lot of them disliking peer recovery specialists, and it's more of a scope of practice thing.
Yeah.
I personally, I don't know if it's because I'm not recovered, but I don't understand that because I love my peer recovery specialists. They help me out so much. I love them to death. They are the lifeblood and they're awesome. So it's hard for me to understand why some don't like them.
Yeah.
Maybe you can help me out with that. I just don't understand.
Well, I think the biggest thing that, and again, what I've heard is they feel a little threatened, that they're there to take their job or do their job or something. I don't know. And also like, well, this person, they only had to take a 46 hour class and I had to go to college for 4 years. Mm-hmm. Like, so there's a little bit of that. I don't think they understand what they do. I think that's the biggest thing to me is they don't understand. Like they're just, I mean, in my mind, the biggest thing a peer recovery specialist is to connect the person to the community. They're that connector. Like, and people ask me like, where do peer recovery specialists like, and if we think of the stages of change, like where do they do their best work or where is their sweet spot? And really peer recovery specialists can work along anywhere in the continuum, but their sweet spot is the action stage. Like once a person has completed primary care, like that's when a peer recovery specialist does their best work, right? But they really can work with them across the, I mean, so I know as an LADC, one thing that I was responsible for with all of my clients, patients was I did all the case management. I did all the care coordination. I did all the, you know, everything, right?
Yes.
And that, now though, that you take that peer specialist and they're gonna help them find housing. They're gonna help them open up a bank account. They're gonna help them, mm-hmm. you know, take them to support group meetings. They're gonna yeah. like they just took a whole bunch of work off of my case, off of me, like, because I don't have to do any of that stuff anymore because they're doing it now. Right. So I look at them as a huge asset. I think yep. if more LABCs looked at it from that perspective, like they're there to take, help you. Like you oh, don't, yeah. I used to have to do all the housing coordination for my clients when they would mm-hmm. start to discharge. Like I have to, you know, and I may as an LADC, like, oh, I have to sign the GRH paperwork and that's it. Like, yep. but I don't have to do anything anymore. Like the peer recovery specialist has helped them find housing, secure housing, yes. Get their driver's license back, like all this stuff that I was yep. doing before. So I don't know that. I think that's the biggest thing is they just don't, they don't know what their, the program. And then we can look at the leadership of the programs because the yes. programs haven't done a good enough job, like educating their staff on what is a peer recovery specialist and what are they yes. supposed to do. So I think right. that's the biggest thing. That's one of the things in my presentation. So this who's who at the zoo is intended to like, the people I want to be presenting in front of are treatment directors, LADCs, yes. Program directors, people, you know, peer recovery specialists can certainly come to the presentation and get their CEUs, but yes. they're not my target audience.
yeah. yeah.
So
I think the biggest thing that we're struggling with is again the coordination of care. What is too much for peer recovery? Like what is too much workload on them? Because sometimes we'll tell them, okay, help me transfer the client to another treatment center, get the paperwork in, and technically that's not the peer recovery specialist's job. Nope. And I guess a lot of peer recovery specialists have been stressed out because, again, that's not their duties, but they're getting like all this work dumped on them.
Yeah. So now you've drifted into the clinical lane.
Yes.
So if you think about the work, so you have to, and this is the concept, and it crosses over and lines get blurred. Sometimes I get that, but what is considered clinical and what is considered non-clinical? So the peer recovery specialist should be doing all of their duties should be in the not all of their duties should be in the non-clinical lane. So when you're starting to connect individuals to treatment programs like that transferring, that's a clinical duty.
Yeah.
Because that's the LADC has to do the discharge summary, has to make sure it gets over to the other treatment program. It has to like, that's all like, to me, that's a clinical duty. You've now moved out of the non-clinical lane. So, but it's hard sometimes like to determine that. I mean, the biggest role that I think peer recovery, if you like, I don't know, like one of the roles I think we should think about I try to think of what's the simplest way to say it. Like think of a peer recovery specialist as a resource broker. Like they help the person either in treatment or leaving treatment find resources. Like maybe it's, you know, maybe it's a gas card so they can get back and forth yes. from work. Maybe it's a, you know, and so just if and I like that to me, if clinical people thought of it more that way, like a resource yes. broker, it's a lot bigger than that. But I think that I try to always think like, what's the simplest thing I can think of? And that to me is the simplest thing. If we can think of them as like the resource broker, the connector mm-hmm. to the community, like that's what peer recovery specialists should be doing.
Right. And I think I hear a lot of them also say too, that they don't want to be considered as like taxi cab drivers. They want to do more. And I completely yeah. understand that too. Cause again, there's even blurred lines between a driver at a treatment center and yeah. peer recovery specialist. There is a huge difference and they are not drivers. They are so much more. No offense to drivers.
Yeah. No. There's some good times though, when a peer recovery specialist being that driver isn't a bad thing. It's like mm-hmm. if someone's trying to, you know, going to a support group meeting for the first time, like it's okay. Like, I think it's a good idea to have a peer recovery specialist driving them there to help them work through those fears yeah. or the insecurities and even like taking them to a methadone clinic. Like, I think it's another yeah. good opportunity to like, to get, you know, but if you're just like the part, sometimes I struggle with like, if a peer recovery specialist is doing a jail pickup, like, I don't know if that's the best time. But then again, I thought, well, maybe it's not a bad time because this will be the first person that they interact with. And it's going to be a person that understands a little bit about what they're going through. So maybe that isn't a bad thing. So I don't know. I think the peer recovery specialist doing the driving piece is a good idea. But then I also see like how that can get into how that can be problematic too. Some of the things that concerns me when I hear like one program, and I'm not going to name names, was right. They had a van and they were having the peer recovery specialist drive the whole group to like wherever, a meeting or an event. And and then what they would do is they would say, well, that peer recovery specialist, they're trying to bill for that. And it's not, that's not what it, like the only way you can bill, it's a one-on-one service, face-to-face, one-on-one. Face-to-face means in-person or virtual, either way, because we can bill telehealth. But so they're billing, like if there's eight people in the van, they're trying to bill 30 minutes for each for a peer recovery service for all eight people, because they're like, oh, they were with them. They were in the van with them. Ooh. Yeah. So there we got to be, I mean, we're going to get like some of that's going to get, it's going to be called fraud. I'm not going to, you know, the powers to be will just claim out. And I believe it's unethical. But I also, again, I wonder, does the program understand that it's not like, maybe they don't even understand that that's not okay. But I don't know. To me, I don't know how you can understand that. But again, I don't want to assume someone's level of understanding or what they've been told. So I hear things like that and I immediately might like, nope, like that's not okay. Like we need to, it's pretty clearly written in statute that it's a one-on-one interaction like
this.
Anyway,
I also feel too, a lot of that has to do with how the peer recovery specialist feels amongst their peers and the leaders and the directors, where their voice needs to be honored and respected. And a lot of times it is not, especially it can be taken different ways. Like say the director's like, hey, pick this guy up from prison or jail, whatever. And not even explaining the importance of your job as a peer recovery specialist in that moment. Like you just said, they're a lot more than a taxi cab driver in that process.
Yeah.
And they need to be honored in that, just like everyone, a part of the team.
Yeah. I mean, we're all supposed to be part of this multidisciplinary team that we, right. And I know, and you know what it's getting, I mean, so peer recovery specialists are, we're in our, like, we're still teenagers, right. We're still in like, I like to compare them to like where, so there was a time. And when I talked to old school people in this field, they said it reminds them of 35 years ago when counselors first were a thing. They were looked at as like, what do you mean? Like, so back in the day to be a counselor, you completed treatment, you went out into the world for about a year and you came back and you were a counselor. Like that was how you became a counselor. Right. And at that time, like people thought this, the same thing, like, who are these people? And they're just, they just finished this program a year ago. They're not any better than I am, or blah, you know, some of the same things were being said. And then it, then reimbursement came into play. And they wanted to make it like, I know some of the original people that wrote the, in Minnesota, that wrote the licensure. And at first it was a 2-year degree. And then they didn't think that was enough. And they made it a 4-year, which I think was a, mistake, and not all bad, but I think there was, when doing that, we complain in this state a lot, or really across the country, about how it's hard to get diversified in our field, diversity, like BIPOC and Indigenous and other people. And I think part of it is that we put this heavy burden of this 4-year burden on, and it's not possible. Yeah. Like if I going through school, like saw my friends and my classmates that had a job, that had a family to raise, that had all this other stuff, and trying to do an 880 hour internship, right? Or something. And like, it just didn't, I don't have kids and I took time up my life off. I didn't have them, but I saw it was so hard on so many people, and that's a huge barrier. But anyways, so I think the deal is, I think we're growing. So again, we're kind of these peer recovery specialists are in this adolescent stage of growth, where we kind of, we're figuring out what we're supposed to do. We're being told by other people what we're supposed to do. We don't know exactly what we're supposed to do. They don't know what we're supposed to do. Like there's a lot of growing pains going on right now. It's going to take a while. Like it's going to like every other new discipline, like it's going to take a while to build momentum and build education and a mutual understanding and legitimacy to what we do. Right. So.
Yep. And again, I feel a huge part of that is coordination of care. And I think that, again, going back to your poster, which I love, it explains like the job aspects of like a counselor, a tech. And I think you also mentioned something about like different names we can call techs nowadays.
Yeah. Oh my God. That gets annoying to me. And I happened, and I'm not going to name the program.
Yep.
I'm just going to pull up my poster here once. But it says, so many programs, and again, I'm not going to name names, are calling their techs a recovery specialist or recovery coach or mm-hmm. there's Recovery Advocate is another one I've heard. So here's what happened, and this is a real life story. I have a friend who applied for a job at a treatment provider here in Minnesota, and it was a recovery specialist job. She thought she was applying to be a peer recovery specialist.
Yes.
The program's definition of recovery specialist is a tech position. So, and she didn't even like, and it's, I can blame her for some of this too. She took the job, and then all of a sudden she's like, she's doing UAs and room searches, and she's not doing, mm-hmm. and then she realized that she's a tech. But then other people in the program started asking her, like, I don't like, so what's the, you're not a peer recovery specialist, but your title says recovery specialist. And so it was confusing, not only for the staff and the program and the clients and the person doing the job. So by convoluting, whatever, that's not the right word, by these mixing these names to make it sound more pleasing, or I don't know, whatever, like, why don't we call it, if it's a duck, call it a duck.
Exactly. Like,
why do we have to make up these names to make it more attractive? Or I don't know the reasoning behind it. So I've been pushing really hard. Like, let's go to the names that we like. It's okay to call them a treatment technician. I do actually love the one I saw it in another state. They called it a behavioral health technician.
Yeah.
Like, to me, that's a great name. Or a client care technician, mm-hmm. a residential technician. Like, but the it's a tech job. So why are we taking the word technician out of it? Because we don't. Because it doesn't, I don't know, because of the sound of it. I don't know. Right. So I've been, and this isn't, Minnesota is not unique to this problem. This is mm-hmm. happening in other states. And that was a really important part of my slide presentation, even my poster board, to make sure that I called that out, because people are confused. Clients right. are confused. Staff is confused. People applying for jobs are confused. Right. So anyways, but yeah, so.
I mean, I remember this one time I worked at a group home. But the title was mental health counselor. And let me tell you, Sarah, there is no mental health counseling involved. Like, you were a tech, but a group home worker, let's say.
Right.
So why not, again, call us a group home worker? Instead, I guess you want to make it sound sexier, so you're a mental health counselor, which you right. do no mental health counseling.
No mental health counseling. That in Washington or Oregon, they actually call their peer recovery specialists recovery counselors.
Okay.
And I don't like that. Like, now you just commingled non-clinical and clinical yes. in one sentence. You non-clinical recovery and clinical counselor. They're not a recovery counselor. Like, that is not what, again, I try to stay in Minnesota, but that's my friends in I think it's Oregon or Washington, I can't remember which one, are like, yeah, the state DHS in their state decided the name.
Yep.
I'm like, yep, there you go again. There's the government agency making decisions for the community, and they have no freaking clue what they're doing. So
absolutely.
Anyways. Yeah.
So another thing with coordination care, like I've always had this inspiration. And when I looked at your poster, I really strengthened that, where I would love someday to create like an app. I don't know how realistic it's going to be, but again, it's having like all the major like fields, like our professions, let's say like social workers, LADCs, LPCCs, techs, case managers. And it's going to explain kind of what their basic job duties are, kind of like what your poster says, yeah. but also how do they coordinate care with one another? So if you're at a hospital and you're in LADC, what is it going to look like with you coordinating with a social worker or a therapist? Yeah. Like, what are some things you may talk about with each other to provide better care for the client?
Yeah. Yeah. There's a few good apps out there that I think are trying to do more of that. So there's one in Pennsylvania called Recovery Link.
Okay.
Really great app. I know the guy that developed it. I think they're doing some work and they're trying to integrate more services into the app. There's another one called, it's called We Connect. I can't remember the name of the organization that developed it. It's another really great app, also trying to incorporate a multidisciplinary approach where there's mm-hmm. more than, you know, it's recovery counselors, you know, other services on there. We have a few apps here in Minnesota, a couple. Well, one that's gotten some legislative funding called Pathway. Dave Wellstone and Joe Morris are the kind of the founders of that organization. I have a friend that works for them she's doing resource mapping for them right now. They're really, it is that one particularly is right now, it's a heavy focus on peer or recovery services though. But I think they're also talking about, but it's a great idea. I don't know. I think in the world we're moving into is, especially, you know, I'm old. I'm going to be 52 here in a couple of weeks. So I'm an old guy. Like, you know, I still like, you know, believe in a handshake and, you know, things like that. But I understand, like, if we want to reach these folks that are, you know, millennials or whatever the new generation is called, like under 30, like we have to really embrace the technology because that's where they live. Like, and I think if, and, you know, especially if we even talk about, if we want to do prevention work, like we have to start reaching these youngsters when they're 10, 11, 12 years old, because that's the time. I mean, people don't want to talk about addiction to 10 and 11 year olds, but I'm telling you, like that, I mean, I just read an article the other day, a 13 year old overdosed in somewhere. God. And I'm thinking like, we need to be starting these conversations really early. And I think one way to do that is like all these, you know, we have Snapchat and TikTok and all that fun stuff. I try to embrace some of that. TikTok I've attempted a few times. I just get more stuck on TikTok watching funny videos than anything. I'm like endless hours of scrolling because I just get stuck on there. I made a few TikTok videos and I don't think I'm not very impressed with myself, but we know that that's how we reach the younger people. And if we don't focus on reaching that younger crowd, we're missing the boat. Like I'm serious, because like, I mean, there's a lot of good science that tells us, and I know the numbers vary, but 90% of adults that have a substance use disorder starting using when they're an adolescent. Like we know that number is really high. And if we can prevent, there's another study that it's a little older, but I read one. If we can even delay someone's first use by 2 years, we can prevent 1.5 million people from developing a substance use disorder later in life. And that's just like, so if someone's 16 and we just like help them not try experiment till they're 18, like we interrupt that cycle enough, we can prevent a lot of later problems. But yeah, I think apps are a good thing. I'm an old guy and it's a little outside of my area, but I think it's a good idea. One of my pieces of my bill that I wrote for recovery services is digital recovery platforms. Okay. Because I do believe that they are an important piece of the puzzle. So I even wrote that into my, and people, oh my God, some of the people thought, what is that? What's a digital recovery program? I said, an app. Like a lot of people utilize apps now. Like, I mean, I have 270 of them installed on my phone for Christ's sake. Right.
Yep.
I said, there are digital apps now for recovery services and they should be able to employ peer recovery specialists to interact with participants and seek some type of reimbursement for it. Like I'm okay. Like if we don't embrace that, I mean, we're missing the boat again. So I did include it in my list and I got some push. That was one of the two areas that I got pushback the most on was the digital place and the hospitals. People thought, well, hospitals they make enough money already. They don't need to bill for and that's not true. Like a lot of hospitals work on a negative budget. Like people don't realize that though. They think, oh, they're a big hospital. They make money. That's not true. Hospitals, a lot of hospitals lose money annually, but they're subsidized by government and things like that because we need the service. But anyways, and when I put hospitals and digital recovery apps or digital recovery organizations in my proposed legislation, those are two areas people lost their damn mind over. Thought, what are you doing? I'm like, well, whatever. Like, what do you think we should do? Like, I love when people sit back and want to get all upset about like, and I'm again, come to the table, like sit with us. Let's talk about this. I want to make this legislation the best it can be. And I want to hear from as many voices as possible. I don't want to do this on my own. Like I'm going to move this forward, but again, you can sit back and you can complain about it or you can join or come on, join us. Let's
or if you're all gonna do this together. Bitch and complain, then you know what? You have to have one or two positive ideas in your mindset that can contribute then, or else you can't bitch and complain.
I've heard from a lot of people over this last week about this bill and I had some good suggestions. And yesterday I emailed the bill author and I crossed out, like they do what's called strike through. And then we bold in what we want to add. So I did some strike throughs and add on the legislation. I sent it to Abel and I said, here are some from the community. Here's some suggestions I've heard. And I think it's a good idea to incorporate them. And I agreed with them. And again, that's what I think people are thinking. I think a lot of people are thinking that are like opposing what I'm doing. This is, I'm just doing this all on my own. I'm not, and I don't really want to be.
Right.
But also I think it's too important right now to our state. I mean, and I can't like, I should probably mention this. So we just got our new budget forecast a couple days ago. Mm-hmm. Our state has a $9.3 billion budget. The biggest budget we've ever seen and we'll probably never see again. And if we don't make some serious investments while we have this opportunity, mm-hmm. we're in trouble. So, and I mean, I think we should make some serious investments in our education system and some yep. serious investments in our mental health and substance use department for sure. I mean, there's a lot of places, yep. but with the overdose rates we have and the, we can see what's happened with the people, the education because of COVID, like the, you know, we already had a crippled education system to begin with and mm-hmm. COVID made that a lot worse. So anyways, I hope our state legislation, the problem is we still have a very divided legislation. We have the House is Democratic, the House is Senate, the governor's is Democratic. However, I mean, if you unfortunately, you have to get all three of them to agree to do something. And if we can't get all three of them to agree, and honestly, it's not a budget year. They don't have to do anything for, they don't have to pass any budget this year. They did that last year. Mm-hmm. And then next year we have to do another new budget. So they literally don't have to spend any of that $9.3 billion if they didn't want to. I think it would be a mistake. And I hope some of the Republicans, I have a lot of Republican friends, but they're the ones mm-hmm. that unfortunately they don't like always to spend money. They want tax cuts. And I don't disagree. Like, but I think like people don't understand how much $1 billion is. So,
oh yeah.
I have a friend who, and I got to find this text really quick. It said, so here it is. So do you know the difference between a million and a billion and a trillion? So a million seconds is 11 days. Mm-hmm. A billion seconds is 32 years.
Wow.
A trillion seconds is 31,688 years. 31,000 years ago, our planet was unrecognizable in the middle of an ice age. when people don't understand those numbers, like 11 days, 32 years, or 32,000 years, like between a million, a billion, and a trillion, $1 billion is a lot of fucking money.
Oh, yes.
and we have $9.3 billion surplus right now. So to me, to spend a few billion dollars to invest in our state is a no-brainer. Yep. But that's just me. So
it puts things in perspective. It really does. I'd say what an honor and a pleasure it was having you on my podcast, man. Just high amount of knowledge and awareness you just presented myself, my listeners, was simply amazing, man. It was, again, awesome having you on.
Yeah, I appreciate it.
So if any of my listeners do want to get a hold of you, what is the best place to do that? Your website, email, or?
So yeah, website is one way. So if you go to www.boldnorthrecoveryandconsulting.com, all one word, type that in. If you just type Bold North Recovery in this search box, it'll probably pop up because I've done my best with Google SEO and that stuff. But anyways, also my email, it's on the website too, but it's info@boldnorthrecovery.com is a really easy way to get a hold of me. But website, email, on the website, there's a submission form. You can type in your name and if you want to get a hold of me, but those are the two easiest way. I have, my Bold North Recovery has, pretty active social media pages. Not as good on Instagram, but I'm on Twitter, LinkedIn, and Facebook for sure. I'm on all the four of the major ones. So you can always find me there too. But yeah, whatever. I love the work I'm doing. I think the peer recovery stuff and the advocacy is what I do a lot of overdose prevention. So I guess I can't exclude that either. Cause last night, I don't know if I did my first ever, that was really emotional for me last night. I went back into the jail where I was once incarcerated when I got arrested, and I did my first ever in custody Narcan training. So I trained inmates how to use Narcan. Being inside that jail, that was the first time I'd gone back into any correctional facility since being released. So I'm not going to lie. It was hearing the doors slam and like all that, you know, all that like just brought back a lot of stuff. But it was really cool. Seven guys showed up for my class and we had great conversation and it was really cool. I left there very inspired. And I hope I gave them some inspiration as well too. But yeah, online, social media, email, a lot of ways to find Randy Anderson for sure online. So
absolutely. Well, thank you, man, so much. I greatly appreciate it, man.
I appreciate it. Thanks for having me, Jacob. And I'm sure our paths will cross many more times as we go along in our journeys here. So
I truly hope so.
I would like to thank my listeners for listening to another great and wonderful episode. I just want to inform all my listeners and everyone that the information and content that was said on this episode was not meant to be taken as any type of therapeutic intervention or advice. If you do find yourself dealing with mental health or addiction issues, please seek the care of an addiction professional, mental health professional, or a licensed medical doctor. All right, thank you and have a wonderful day. Bye.